I think we can tell you're not sponsored because you can't pronounce the name correctly.
Oh, what is it? Did you actually find the real pronunciation?
I've got no idea, but you don't know either, so no one really knows. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 19 of the Swift Over Coffee podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Sean Allen.
And at last, we're able to say for absolutely sure this time, we are definitely doing a live podcast during WWDC week, which is just, 3 weeks from when we record this thing, thanks to AltConf. Tickets are going to be free, but they will be limited. So if you're in the area for WWDC or AltConf or TriSwift or Layers, whatever, please watch Twitter for the link so you can get your ticket.
Yeah, and Paul, is not going to be just us. We're going to have some special guests here. We're going to have Christina Fox, Guy Rambo, Kaya Thomas, JP Samard. They're all going to join us for a WWDC extravaganza. You're not going to want to miss this one.
It's going to be Wednesday, June the 5th from 5:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. Like I said, we're getting tickets out there real soon now. And it ends half an hour before James Dempsey and the Breakpoint start, which is a great event. So you can come to us, see a live podcast with our friends, and then go straight to James Dempsey and the Breakpoints. So that's going to be awesome. I'm looking forward to that. In the meantime, Sean, what have you been up to?
I got some big news that I announced the other week on my YouTube channel is that I have actually canceled some of the interviews I had scheduled and I've decided to go full-time content creation in air quotes that you can't see. And that's because full-time means 70% content creation and 30% contracting because, one, I got to pay the bills and I enjoy contracting and it keeps me kind of in the industry and still learning and a long ways to go. So roll right in from DubDub right into full-time content creation. So if you are a fan of the YouTube channel, you're going to get a lot of content over the coming months.
This is basically a posh way of saying you'll be playing games on Twitch, right?
Shh, that's my... don't spoil the secret.
Tell the tax man.
Yeah, yeah. I'm masquerading as full-time content creator as, full-time... No, I'm not going to go full-time video game playing, but I am going to do some live streams on Twitch just as a more fun way to do my live streams iOS, Q&A. Figure that's more fun than me just staring into a camera. Paul, you got a big announcement as well. You just launched yet another thing?
Well, I've been working on it for a while, but it took me a while to get it over the edge. And Julian Schiavo and Wayne Neihardt really helped push over the finishing line. It's my app for learning Swift on iOS, Unwrap. It's on iPad and iPhone. It's completely free with no in-app purchases. And it's finally out and it's doing super well. We've had something like 300 reviews already, which is fantastic. Thank you very much for that. So we're all, I think, 4,000 or 5,000 downloads now in the last 2 or 3 days. It's doing really well. Like I say, it's completely free. So we'll link to the show notes. Go and check it out and see what you think.
All right, Paul, time to talk about some news. And first up, we have something that everybody seems to be excited about, and that is Swift compiling on WebAssembly, thanks to SwiftWASM. I'm not going to lie, I'm not that familiar with WebAssembly, and I had to do a lot of Googling in preparation for this episode, but even that didn't quite clear things up. But like I said, people seem to be really happy about this, and I'm sure many listeners out there might be like me and not quite sure what this all means. So I just really wish we had somebody to talk to here that actually kind of knows what's going on. Do you think we can find someone?
Let me ask you a simple question, Sean. Do you want to be a full stack Swift developer?
What does that even mean? I feel like anytime somebody says that, I don't even know what that means. No, I know what you're saying. Yes, I would love to be a full stack Swift developer.
It means you got a nice bullet point in your LinkedIn resume, I think, is what it really
means.
There
you go, yeah.
SwiftWASM is something I've been hoping for a long time. But honestly, I was expecting Apple to do it. And they still might, of course, because WWDC 19 is only a few weeks away at this point. Whether you like it or not, JavaScript has one important superpower over all other languages, and that is it's pretty much everywhere. Anywhere it can run, it does run. And many places like, the back end for websites or even app development have alternatives, right? We can use Swift for server APIs and Swift for apps and similar. But JS has one place where it's pretty much the only choice, and that's the web front end as a scripting language for websites. And WASM is a compiled binary blob. It's an executable that most, if not all, browsers actually are compatible with, and it eliminates the need for JavaScript. You can compile any language you like down to WASM, WebAssembly, and it just works fine as a replacement for JavaScript.
So now it's starting to clear up a little bit. So you could potentially turn Swift into a front-end scripting language, like you said, kind of just like JavaScript. So typical front end kind of code stack, if you will, could be like HTML, CSS, and Swift instead of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript?
Exactly. From our perspective, for sure, all end users see is HTML, CSS, WASM. And it could have been JavaScript, it could have been C++, it could have been Rust, they both actually work with WASM already, or it could be Swift once this thing stabilizes. They just see the same output. So we can have all the language we know and love, boom, right there. But until now, it's worked in C++, worked in Rust and similar, but there's been no movement from Swift, at least from Apple, until now. And LLVM, which is the underlying compiler system underneath Swift, has support for WASM. But Swift has some very clever things that cause problems in WASM, which has hit issues, at least so far. For example, map is a rethrowing function, which means it can be throwing or it can be non-throwing depending on what closure you pass to it, which is incompatible with WASM because it has very strict and simple function signature checking. So that needs more work, but it's still a huge step forward.
All right, so let's keep count here. We have obviously Swift for iOS apps. We have server-side Swift. Now we have Swift, front-end web development Swift. We got Chris Lattner over at TensorFlow using Swift and machine learning. Is Swift starting to take over the world? Are we seeing it, the beginnings of it?
You can also get Swift Microbit, you know. You can flash your Microbit.
I don't even know what a Microbit is.
It's a BBC project here in the UK. They basically made this tiny, tiny physical computer, the simplest possible thing you can code, and mailed it out free of charge to several million school children. They all got one. And you can flash that to put Swift directly on it. Yeah, you get Swift on Raspberry Pi.
It is taking over the world. That's what it sounds like to me. Moving on, we have some quick Swift evolution updates. And let's start with SE0259, approximate equality for the floating point. That was sent back for revision. We talked about that last episode, I believe. And it was specifically around how they're handling zero. So kind of put a pin in that. We'll talk more about that potentially later as we find out what's going on. But that got sent back to the drawing board. And then we have SE0260, library evolution for stable ABIs. That's in review until May 21st. This proposal adds a library evolution mode for the compiler, and that's off by default. But any libraries that build with this will be said to be ABI stable.
I think it's fair to say that in the run-up to DubDub, things are getting nice and quiet in evolution, which is great for us. Gives us a nice little breather. We can relax for a while, play some games, you can stream some games. but let's face it, it probably means that Swift 5.1 is landing soon. My bet is at DubDub, probably in beta form, it'll then go through to September. When Xcode 11 ships, it'll ship with 5.1 at that point, which means 5.2 around March and 6, whatever that means, next DubDub. That's my prediction. But I think the library evolution is interesting, though, because it more or less gives us the same opportunity to make things stable in our libraries, like Alamo Fire or whatever, as the Swift standard library had in Swift 5.
Next up, we have an article from Craig Hockenberry called What to Expect from Marzipan. For those that aren't familiar with Craig, he wrote one of the first Twitter apps before Twitter even had an app. And he is the author of Twitterific, if that name rings a bell to you. So his article is all about what to expect from Marzipan. And Marzipan is, you know, Apple's way to build iOS apps on macOS. And he talks about some of what the repercussions will be. And we're going to hit some points here. And the first one we want to discuss is, what is that going to do to the prices of macOS apps, right? We all know iOS apps are basically free or 99 cents, whereas macOS, we're more trained to pay a little more money for that. So, I mean, I think we kind of know what's going to happen, but what do you think is going to happen, Paul?
Well, either iOS apps will have their price raised to macOS levels, or we'll continue our race to the bottom and macOS apps will collapse. Yeah. let's face it, there's only one option here. And it's sad because the problem with the race to the bottom is you might actually win. And then what do you do?
Yeah, not good. Another cool thing he talks about in the article that I definitely want to share as somebody who is a less experienced developer, somebody who's only been doing it 4 years, is to pay attention to the history of this stuff. Because right now, you have a lot of people thinking, you know, maybe Marzipan isn't that great right now, and why are we going away from AppKit? AppKit is like the proper way to make macOS apps. But you're also comparing AppKit of today to Marzipan, not even 1.0 yet. I don't know if it's going to be 1.0 when it comes out, but it's just the very beginning of Marzipan. So that's a tough comparison. So pay attention to that history.
What I find interesting is that, you know, what we see today of Marzipan, which is new stocks, you know, Home and similar in Mojave, you know, shipped and beta form in June last year. They'd obviously done some work in that beforehand, but not a great deal. That was their first real shipping version. They've had a full year of time to refine that and fix it and update it. It's going to be different. What we see in 3 weeks' time is going to be different and going to be better. I feel pretty much certain of that.
And then finally, I think is a good thing to bring up for those of us like me who have only worked on iOS haven't even embarked on, you know, macOS or AppKit is the idea of design, because there's different design paradigms on macOS than there are for iOS. So the article also suggests to check out the macOS human interface guidelines and familiarize yourself with that so you can be ready to keep up with conventions.
Honestly, I have no idea what the interface guidelines will be like in 3 weeks' time, because it can't be iOS and it can't be macOS. They're going to have to find some way of unifying the two, unless they've done significantly amazing work to make it actually just magically happen, which is, it's possible. But we've seen the current UI date picker on macOS, and it's awful. You've got to sort of scroll through the little mouse clicker thing. It's just terrible. So they clearly have more work to do on that, and hopefully in 3 weeks' time, we'll know for sure.
All right, Paul, as always with every episode, we got some picks to talk about. What do you got for us?
So my pick is a new feature coming in Swift 5.1 called opaque return values. And I had to spend a whole day just hacking around with this thing before I really felt like I was getting the most from it. But it's a really powerful feature that I think will solve a number of corner cases that folks are hitting right now. Brace yourself though, this is a tricky feature. And if you're relatively new to Swift, you might struggle to see its usefulness. Are you braced, Sean?
I'm so braced. Give it to me.
Okay, so opaque return types let's return some specific type of object from a function without actually specifying precisely what it is. So if we had a protocol called employee, right, and we had struct called doctor, surgeon, and nurse that all conform to employee, we could write a function that returned one of those without specifically saying which one. We'd just say it was some sort of employee.
Well, can't you kind of already do that in Swift 5, just use the protocol for return type?
Sort of. The problem there is that if you return an employee, like a protocol employee, it means you could send back a doctor, a surgeon, or a nurse. You can decide at runtime, you know, roll a dice and return one of those things. Whereas if you're using an opaque return type, then it might be doctor or surgeon or nurse, exclusive or. The function must return only one of those three rather than any of them.
But then you could just say the function returns whichever one you want.
Again, yes, sort of, technically could, like return a doctor, but then you lose the option to change your mind in the future. You know, what we're saying is this thing returns some sort of employee with an opaque type, and whoever calls that function has to treat the return value as an employee. It can't assume it has, you know, a doctor or a surgeon, whatever. So you can send back a nurse now, and then in 2 weeks change the doctor, and then in 4 weeks change the surgeon, and nothing else needs to change.
I feel like you might be talking circles around me. I thought you just said it had to return one or the other. I'm confused.
It has to return one specific type at compile time. But if you change the function to return something else and then rebuild, that's also okay. What matters is when the code runs, it must always return the same type, even though it doesn't say specifically what that is. In fact, if you try and return, like if you did if bool.random return doctor, otherwise return nurse, it won't even compile. It has to return exactly one type always.
I feel like we're getting like real nitpicky here, and that's a pretty small distinction. Like, I don't know the use case. I can't picture that. Why is this actually useful?
There are various places. First, it does avoid really clearly the dreaded message you get. You can't use this protocol here. It has self or associated type requirements, which is really annoying. You know, if you want to return a protocol from a function, that's fine, but you can't return equatable. That's a protocol, but you can't return that from a function. Because it makes no sense by itself. What does equatable mean? You know, one type is only equatable with other things of that type, not with all types. With opaque types, we can send back equatable just fine. Because the underlying compiler knows what's really behind there. It knows equatable string, equatable int behind the scenes. And Swift will make sure we only use it with other instances of the same type. It'll say, well, you got an equatable string, got another equatable string, put them together, that's fine. So that's one reason. Second, even though we don't know what the opaque type contains, Swift does, which means we can do runtime typecasting if we want to. We can say, if let this thing as a doctor, then work with it. So we can do typecasting and Swift will say, that's fine, and work with it. And third, and most importantly for some people, we can hide all sorts of implementation details. Now, this is an area where the Swift standard library kind of leaks all over the place, you know, with things you shouldn't care about. I love the example of the lazy drop while sequence. If you have like array of 1, 3, and 5 and do dot lazy dot drop while, you get back a dedicated type called lazy drop while sequence. And I don't want to know about that. I don't want to care about that. That's internal standard library stuff, right? So really, it'll send us back some sort of sequence, we don't care what, which you can't do right now. You can't return a sequence. It isn't possible. So hopefully, opaque return types will make that happen.
And we can look for this exciting new feature in Swift 5.1, right?
Honestly, you're going to use it once a year, but you'll be so glad it's there for that once a year. Like, yes, I can return this thing now. Hooray. It is there in the latest snapshot. So go and try it out. And keep braced if you can, because this is the tip of the iceberg for more generic code changes in Swift. Because this is the part of a new improving the UI of generics in Swift scheme they have. 5.2, 6, and so forth. We're going to see much more of this stuff. So stay braced. So that's my pick, Sean. What do you have this time?
Well, before we move on, I want everybody to tweet. Whenever you use an opaque return type, tweet at Paul, mention him. I want his mentions to blow up when everybody actually uses this. And this will be the test to see if people are actually using this function.
They'll be so grateful.
So anyway, my pick of this week is an awesome Mac app I recently discovered called Rotato.
I think it's called Rotato, isn't it?
Tomato Rotato. I messed that joke up, but maybe that'll be the intro. Sean messing up jokes here. Rotato. Who cares? But I featured it on Swift News a couple months ago, and you know, I just started playing around with it, and I absolutely love it. And I'm not gonna lie, I kind of gave a little bit of pause before making this my pick, because I think like once you know word gets out that all the other iOS YouTubers are gonna use it, and it's gonna become not cool anymore. But you know, sharing is caring, right? So, Paul, if my eyes didn't deceive me, I saw your launch video for Unwrap, and you got some very similar motion graphics going on as well. Are you playing with this?
No, I am old school. I dedicated time to learning After Effects. And that's a skill that's proven useful time and time again.
No, I wish I had After Effects skills. You're doing it like the real way. I'm using the kindergarten like wrapper around it to make it easy. But you know, before I start gushing about it, let me explain like what it is and what it does. And it basically provides like amazing looking 3D renders of devices. Talking iPhones, Android phones, whatever those are, MacBooks, etc. And you can manipulate and position these renders to take great looking still shots of your apps on all these devices. And you can even create movies of these renders, you know, kind of similar to what you see in like Apple commercials when phones are flying around, etc. The whole point is, if you're looking to present your app via video, website, keynote, whatever, this is going to take that presentation to the next level. And if you've seen some of my recent videos, like you've seen this in action.
Actually, one of the things I love about the Apple commercials is they actually filmed them all.
It's crazy to think that. I know. Every time I hear that, I'm like, wow.
The flame they had in the Apple Watch Series 5, I think it was, or Series 4, it was all filmed in super slow motion, and they don't use effects at all. They're like, wow, that's what $11 billion buys you.
right, yeah.
Anyway, it sounds like I can expect to see developers really up in the game when it comes to promoting their app. Is that about right?
Yeah, I mean, I know, you know, this sounds like, oh, Sean, cool. It's cool for your YouTube videos. What use is it for me, right? But I think nearly all developers, you know, out there can benefit from this, you know, mainly from capturing the still images or even the movies, right, of your app running on a device. And it's for your portfolio, right? Because when creating your portfolio, great visuals go a really, really long way. And I know there's been plenty of like Sketch and Photoshop iPhone templates out there, but you know, the power of Rotato, is that you can drag, zoom, move, and manipulate this 3D render device to get the exact, you know, angle, size. You can get the exact look you're going for. And if you're really trying to take it to the next level, again, you can have like videos and movies that kind of look like an Apple commercial. So it'll really set you apart.
So it sounds like I can use Rotato, however you pronounce it, for some things. I can basically ditch After Effects. You know, it sounds painful to me. I love After Effects, but you know.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like the long way of doing it. I'm sure, I mean, After Effects is so powerful. Like I said, I want to and probably need to learn it myself. But if you just need some like basic, incredibly simple functionality, this can definitely help out here. So if you're curious about this, let's talk about how to use it a little bit. And like I said, the basic functionality is so simple to use. There are preset animations that you can export into a .mov file, which is literally a single click. And the cool thing is you can plug your phone into your computer via Lightning and Rotato, that's gonna be the official name, I think, from now on. It's just Rotato. It's just not a single name. It will mirror like whatever is on your phone. So as these cool, you know, swooping animations of the phone are playing, you can actually be navigating and scrolling, you know, through your app to get like a really cool effect. And you know, that's just the basic functionality. If you really want to dive in and create your own awesome animation, you can create that through keyframes, and the possibilities are endless. And No, I'm not sponsored by Rotato, even though I do have my affiliate link application in there. I'm just super excited about the product. I'm probably going to overdo it in my videos, so I apologize in advance. I just think it looks so cool. So anyway, check that out. It's at rotato.xyz. It is a free app, so you can download it, play around with it, see if you like it. If you want to get rid of their little watermark on the website, it is going to cost you $46 to remove that. So if you do use it for an app landing page, an app launch video, or your portfolio, you're probably going to have to do that. But yeah, check it out.
And now it's time for our open bat. Our question this time made a lot of responses, which is fantastic to see. It was this: what are your tips for doing effective code review? First up, we have Marco Pont, a real friend of the show, saying keep pull requests under 500 lines of code so the reviewer isn't overloaded with a bunch of changes at once. And Brad Root said, keep pull requests small and limited to one feature or change so they're easy to understand. Sometimes this means multiple pull requests for a single new feature due to refactoring or changing existing code to support it before building it in. This is obviously a great idea. I fully agree with both of these two things. I do question the 500 lines of code thing. If someone gave me a 500 line of code pull request, I'd probably close it and refuse to fix it until they made it four different pull requests. Because my brain, I don't think, can comprehend 500 lines of Sonos's code, at a professional level, effectively. What about you, Sean?
Yeah, this is funny. I mean, now I agree 100% with this, now that I'm a little more mature in my development experience. But I do remember when I was a junior developer, the first time I had a more senior developer reviewing my code, I just submitted monsters. And like, I didn't know any better. And, you know, bless his heart, he never said a word, you know, never said, hey, this is huge. He just reviewed it, never said anything, which I wish he did. But now that I've, you know, moved on and, you know, I'm reviewing other people's code, yes, I absolutely see the value in this. And I cringe thinking back at some of the pull requests I sent out to him.
We had some great feedback about linters. Abdul said, using linters is a must. Lets you spend less time on stylistic suggestions. And Christaps Grinberg says, I try to put myself in others' shoes. Try not to force my opinion rather than understand or explain it. And SwiftLint and Danger helps automate a lot of style and other stuff.
Yeah, if you're an avid listener of Swift Over Coffee, you'll know that I expressed my love for SwiftLint in last episode. That was my pick. So absolutely, I'm going to agree with this because, like I said, last episode was most of my comments on PRs were stylistic stuff. It was a waste of my time and the submitter's time. So get a linter and save both people some time.
And with SwiftLint particularly, keep it up to date. Jeff Kelly gave me a nudge on Unwrap recently because we could bump the SwiftLint version up to, you know, 0.01 higher, which sounds, you know, tiny, but it adds new rules. And I actually caught something immediately in our source code with a new rule he added, which is using reduce to a boolean is now better than using all satisfy. It's faster because it'll bail out of the loop faster as soon as it gets a failure. So yeah, keep SwiftLint up to date as well. Next up, we had some answers about continuous integration, or CI. Owen Henley said, we have a Fastlane script we must run before submitting a pull request. It handles all linting, code generation, testing, etc. And once that passes, we can make a PR and have a template with checkmarks to say what we've done to prove this is PR worthy. Damien Rambu says, have a good CI pipeline, or at least use Fastlane to automate findings like linter issues, security issues, and failing UI tests. Yeah, this is so important. You know, there are some really great online CI tools you can just use. They're all cloud-based things like CircleCI or Bitrise or similar. And they do the same sort of thing. You know, you give them access to your GitHub repo. They'll check it out on all builds and all PRs, run all your tests for you and tell you if it passed or not. And you can even enable GitHub features like, you know, do not let this be merged until it's got a green light from the automated CI. So yeah, having automation for continuous integration is a huge, huge thing.
Yeah, I don't have a ton of experience with continuous integration, to be honest, but obviously the concept is kind of common sense, right? If you can automate a lot of the checks before you even submit the PR and to catch all that stuff, yeah, I agree with that.
We had lots of feedback about just being a good human being, quite frankly. Paul Adelianu said, read the whole thing before you start making suggestions. That's so important. You'll get a good context beforehand. Mark O'Hara said, if someone's new or less experienced, focus on building them up and suggest changes incrementally. Be willing to let some lower quality PRs in while they get up to speed, as drawn out changes going back and forth will stop their confidence. Rob Whitaker said, treat it exactly the same as any other interaction in life. People's intentions are usually good, and usually know more about their work than you do. And Adam Guest said, if you're unsure, give the user every chance to show you how good they are. Being grumpy is an easy trap to fall into, but it never really helps.
Yeah, Paul, like you said in the beginning, just being a good human being is kind of the correct answer to almost everything. But I want to contend Mark O'Hara's point a little bit about being willing to let some lower quality PRs, you know, slip through as this new person is getting up to speed, just to not damage their confidence. And I'm not sure if I agree with that, because I'm actively, you know, bringing somebody up to speed on a code base, a brand new junior developer. And, you know, some of his stuff is repeated mistakes, but I keep pointing them out. And I know everybody learns differently, but I feel like keep calling it out is better to help them learn faster rather than to let some slip through.
I saw a fantastic tweet from Frank Kruger, who has done AppDev for a long time. And he talked about how his GitHub PR management style is changing, where it used to be doing code review again and again and again until it was exactly how he personally would have solved the problem. And his new style, he says, he summarized it as just merge the PR, fix it in post if needed, get over yourself. And that single tweet has dramatically affected the way I do pull requests. Because I used to be very much the first camp. I'd add, you know, do an overall review in the comment box, then go by various lines in GitHub and say this or this or this or this, whatever. And it was really detailed and really nitpicky. And it wasn't helping people. It wasn't getting them where they want to be. Often I found now I just merge the PR, change it myself, push it back and say, here's what I was thinking, here's why it's an improvement, and let them learn from my code rather than them feel like they're being set up to fail. So it's a fine line, but I can understand why the goal is to, well, ultimately the goal is simple, get these folks up to speed fast. And I found that my approach of not nitpicking, but being increasingly precise over changes wasn't getting the result I wanted, whereas a new thing really is. A response from Christina Fox saying, use PR checklists. And she links to a blog post she wrote, which I'll put in the show notes. You know, what's a bare minimum? Testing on device, unit tests, integration tests, or similar things like that, localized strings. So just get a bare bones checklist to go through and say, yes, all down the line, it's all good. And we have some wonderful points from Baz Brook from the Contravariance podcast. He says, you know, point out the good things, provide constructive criticism, do it in over a call or in person if it's hard to get over in a pull request response and comment in GitHub, and be kind to people. I want to end on, we have Ellen Shapiro who says, I feel like this should be obvious, but it still needs to be said. Don't be, Ellen's colorful language, don't be a meanie.
I think you shouldn't misquote her, Paul. I think it's not right to misquote people. I think you should quote her.
All right, just for you, Sean, you've asked for it. I'm going to say, here we go. She said, don't be an...
That's going to wrap up this episode of Swift Over Coffee. But as always, we want to leave you with the next open ballot. We're super pumped. We hope you are. And that is, what developer changes, very specific word there, developer changes. I know the answers are going to be dark mode. It's not a developer change. What developer changes do you want most to see announced at WWDC?
Every year, Sean, I have the same list in my head of things I want to see. Things like handwriting recognition, things like a weather API, so I can have weather in my calendar apps and similar. I'm always let down, but it's still just a super exciting time of year. It's like the weeks before Christmas, you know, it's just a wonderful buzz going on right now. I love it.
Before we go, don't forget we're doing a live Swift Over Coffee podcast at AltConf. So be sure to follow all three of us. That's at SeanAllen_dev, at Two Straws, and at Swift Over Coffee. We'll be posting about tickets very soon. They are free, but limited. And again, this is Wednesday, June 5th from 5:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. And don't forget about our special guests. We're going to have Christina Fox, Guy Rambo, Kaya Thomas, and JP Samard for a very special and a little bit longer episode. You're not going to want to miss it.
It's going to be so awesome. It was so much fun last time at iOS Con in London. This will be bigger and better with our friends coming along too. I look forward to seeing you there.
All right, that's going to do it for us. We'll talk to you in the next one.
Bye.